Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. American media is reporting that Israel's spying agency Mossad assassinated Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh last year, as Iran's intelligence had reported shortly following the terror act last year. Tel Aviv was responsible for murdering Dr. Fakhrizadeh. Now, the report also talks about the U.S.'s collusion in the terrorist act at the highest levels. Why is the U.S. media simply reporting this now, and why isn't terrorism condemned and the culprits made to pay instead of simply reporting that this rogue entity committed these acts as if that is normal? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this in the Spotlight.
Has revealed new details about the last year assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Israel was already long believed to have been behind the murder that took place on November 27, 2020. Immediately after the killing, an informed source told Press TV that the remains of the weapon used in the assassination showed that it had been made in Israel. But a recent New York Times article publicizes fresh information, including the fact that Fakhrizadeh was at the top of Israel's hit list since 2007. That entailed an assassination plot in 2009, which was called off at the last moment, as Israel's spy agency Mossad feared its scheme had been compromised. The article by the American Daily also confirmed earlier declarations by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC had said a satellite-controlled machine gun with artificial intelligence was used to take out the scientist. Perhaps most significantly, though, the report sheds light on the extensive collusion of the U.S. in the assassination. It says preparation for the operation began after a series of meetings in late 2019 and early 2020 between Israeli officials and high-ranking American authorities. Those meetings were led by the then Mossad director, Yossi Cohen, and former U.S. President Donald Trump, his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and the then CIA director, Gina Haspel. Fakhrizadeh's killing was the latest desperate effort in the joint Israeli-U.S. venture to derail Iran's nuclear program, a campaign that has included several other assassinations, acts of sabotage, and cyber attacks. While promising revenge and justice, Iran has refused to be cowed and remains resolute in pushing ahead with its nuclear program. However, the brazen U.S. and Israeli violation of international law and human rights should alarm the international community, whose apathy and muted response may come back to haunt it.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight, Hafsa Khair Mostafa, journalist and political analyst out of London. And Mostafa Khoshkesh, journalist and political commentator out of Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with me on the Spotlight. Well, let's start it off with Hafsa. Good to see you. It's been a long time. Why do you think the U.S. media is reporting that Mossad committed this act of terrorism now?
It's difficult to say, but I would assume that first of all, there's a sort of a step-by-step way in which these killings are usually carried out. First, they do them. No one takes responsibility for them. When a country such as Iran actually points the finger at the culprit, they will then say you're a conspiracy theorist. You're obviously automatically blaming Mossad, which is a classic tactic. And then once the story has been completely forgotten, they come back and then they take responsibility for it in order to come across as democratic and people who actually carry out investigations. So throughout these step-by-steps, and we've seen this many, many times, it's sort of like constantly win, win, win. First of all, they get to accuse the victim of being conspiracy theorist. And second of all, they then come across about a year later or several years later coming back and saying, well, actually, we have done our work, we have investigated, and this happens to have been carried out by our closest ally, Israel. So I would suspect this is why they've done it at this moment in time. Exactly why, I cannot say, I'm afraid, but I think this sort of carries, it sort of follows the usual step-by-step way with which these assassinations are carried out.
Mostafa, the article talks about U.S. collusion at the highest level. So this information is reported, and at the end, nothing is done about this. None of them, neither entity is held responsible. I mean, what is this? Is this simply the law of the jungle?
Hello, Marzia, and thanks for having me. Well, let me answer the question that you asked from my colleague first, if I may.
Sure.
The report doesn't give you anything new. The whole reporting that it does had already been stated by Iranian news agencies, including Iran's Fars news agency, gave a full and detailed explanation about events that day, the day that Dr. Fakhrizadeh was assassinated, the trajectory, the developments in detail, especially about the weapon that was used. They said that it was a remotely operated machine gun. They even released a picture of a full range or class of such weapons that are produced by NATO members like Spain, Sweden, Belgium, the United States, Russia, China, and even Iran. In a follow-up report, they even released a picture of an Iranian rival of the same product to disclose that it has been such a weapon. But many inside and outside Iran rejected the report outright for being some kind of oversimplification. So there is nothing new in this report that comes forward, but the aim is building up credit for Israel and Israeli Secret Service and Mossad. First, with regard to the weapon that they have used, Ronan Bergman, who's known to be a Mossad agent, is trying to say that it's been a robot. We do know that robots act independently. They don't need an operator. If you got a drone technology, a UAV technology, that sends, you know, an operator, works with the drone and shoots and targets through bombings and comes back home, then you definitely could make such a remotely operated machine gun. It doesn't have anything but a few optical cameras, and you need the satellite connection, and that's it. But you know what matters in here, that he is trying to say it's been a robot in order to claim that it's been a clear-cut technology owned by Israel, especially when he says that it's been the first time that such a weapon has been used and made by the Israelis. So it's a false reporting in order to make credit. That's the first thing. The second thing is taking credit for highly valued targets. It's the first time that they claim responsibility, because he is known to be a Mossad agent. It matters a lot that he claims responsibility for the assassination of several Iranian scientists. But at the conclusion, he tries to claim responsibility for the death of the father of Iran's missile industry, Major Tehrani Mogaddam, which is absurd because it was an incident. We do know it because General Tehrani Mogaddam evacuated the facility and area through automatic, systematic reporting because of the risks and danger. A day earlier, he informed everyone to evacuate the facility, except for his team of a few dozens.
So at the end of the day, Mostafa, what you're saying is basically they're trying to use this article to create this image that Israel is invincible and can do whatever it wants at any time, anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Stay with me, Mostafa. Let me get Hafsa. Let me get Hafsa back in on this conversation. Hafsa, I'm going to throw that question that I had mentioned to Mostafa back at you. Basically, this whole what does it mean when you have this so-called law of the jungle that's basically the norm now?
I mean, you said it perfectly well. It is about saying that we can do whatever we want and we won't be accountable for it. This is not, as I said previously, this isn't the first time. Remember back in Dubai a few years back, they assassinated quite openly Hamas militants and they took credit for it, and their allies fully recognized that they had done it. There was some sort of very mealy-mouthed condemnation, because of course you don't do that. These were official representatives of Hamas who'd been assassinated in some sort of James Bond-esque scenario. And what the Israelis like to do is precisely show off to the world that they are invincible. Why? Because they have the backing and the support and the unconditional support of the most powerful nation on the planet. And in this case, given that even the president of the United States himself was present at the meeting, this literally confirms that this was done not only with their full acknowledgement, but with their full cooperation. So it's a way of saying, well, you can't touch us because here's who's backing, who's got our backs. And they will take credit for it because it does show Israel to be invincible. And let's not forget that they don't just have the backing of the US, they have the unconditional backing of the EU, and they also have strong support with Putin's Russia. So in essence, Israel really has the backing and the support of the most powerful nations on the planet, and this is why it behaves in such a roguish manner.
Mostafa, what is interesting about this article is that it does not mention any international agency such as the UN condemning the terrorist act, nor does it talk about making sure the perpetrators pay for the crime. It's absolutely amazing that you're talking about this type of terrorism, but on the other hand, nothing is said about any type of accountability. Your take about the lack of any action by these so-called international agencies?
Well, double standards have caused the spread of terrorism all across the globe. More interestingly, I mean, if this report is interesting, it's because of three points that happened for the first time, and this would lay a very big question mark on the role of the United Nations and the world community, why they refuse to take action against the Israeli state terrorism. The first point in here is that it's the first time, Ronan Bergman, he has authored several books and articles all aimed at Iran. You don't get access to such sensitive information unless you're a part of the Mossad or some secret service. And even if you do, when you release such vital information, you are jailed, you are persecuted. If it's not part of the Israeli or any other secret service plan against the target, Bergman actually has been working on mass intimidation among the target nation, that's the Iranian nation, among Iranian officials, to intimidate them, to show that Israel has a superior hand, when we know that Israel is very fragile and under much pressure from inside, from outside, from the side of the Palestinians and others. Now, he is part of, this Israeli Mossad soft operation plan against the Iranian nation. He has got an endorsed mission by them. That's why it matters a lot when he claims responsibility for the assassination of Dr. Masoud Ali Mohammadi. It's the first time that they claim responsibility for his assassination in 2010. The second point, it's the first time he claims responsibility that assassin, the motor rider who stuck the bomb to the car door, was Majid Fashi, and the guy that was arrested, tried and executed by Iran after he appeared on Iranian TV to make public confessions about the detail of how he was trained in Israel and how he worked for the Israeli Mossad agency. The Israelis have always denied any kind of, link to Majid Jamal Fashi. A third point, which still is much more important, is the first time that Israelis claim responsibility for the assassination of Iranian university professor and scientist Dr. Ardashir Hosseinpour in 2007 after they poisoned him with radioactive material. That matters a lot. That shows different kind of terrorism done by Israelis so openly in conjunction, partnership, and complicity with the United States, and the world refuses to take any kind of action, and they just know that Israel is the only Middle Eastern regime that is armed with nuclear weapons. They are a terrorist regime, and still the IAEA pressures Iran and intimidates Iran with resolution at the Board of Governors, and the Europeans are asking Iran, and the U.S. is pressuring Iran through sanctions to get back to the Vienna talks, and they have given the Israelis the role of intimidation within the U.S. containment strategy. They want Israel to intimidate the Iranian nation, and that's why they have released the report right now.
Well, Hafsa, on the one hand, Western countries have been talking about their war on terrorism for 20 years, and on the other hand, they participated, encouraged, and or ignored some of the main terrorist attacks during that same period. What does all this mean? I mean, how do you put all of this together?
Well, I think essentially these imperialist nations were built on terrorism, were built on the violation of the basic rights of the countries and the peoples they colonize. And I think they perpetrate this sort of policy and mindset. Just recently, we learned that in leaving Afghanistan, they literally exterminated an entire family. Now, of course, for some bizarre reason, they've actually come clean and they did recognize the error. But had they not recognized it, we would just have assumed that they were legitimate war targets. And no one would be the wiser. The idea is that the bottom line is that for these nations, these supremacist nations, countries of the South essentially, are disposable. The lives of their people are not, they do not have the same values as those of Western nations, and they continue to behave in such a way. Just to pick up on the point about the NGOs, I have to say that these supposedly international NGOs are simply there to provide, more often than not, the modus operandi, the casus belli for countries to go to war. We've seen this many times, Amnesty International literally backing up accusations that are made up essentially by Western nations and then coming clean, for instance, a few years down the line saying, well, actually, we got that wrong. I'm thinking, for instance, Amnesty International in the case of Libya, when they came up with stories that Libyan soldiers were using Viagra to gang rape women. And then 5 years later, they recognized that it was a completely wrong mistake, that it was absolutely a fabricated story. But at the time of the invasion and the attack on Libya, this was pushed by Hillary Clinton, for instance, as a case for going to war. Cases such as these are numerous across the world, and they're constantly used by NGOs who are essentially the PR agencies of these governments, because they come forward and they provide the case, and they make the PR for war. These then are used as supposedly credible sources, and public opinion then starts backing conflict against the countries of the South. So this is nothing more than a perpetuation of imperialistic attitudes and supremacist attitudes, whereby these countries behave with the countries of the South in a way that is based on terrorism, simply because they do not recognize that the peoples of the South have the same value as their own.
Mustafa, Dr. Fakhrizadeh was a top scientist of a course, and he was working on a COVID-19 vaccine even. Imagine any of these entities and their top scientists being assassinated by another government. I mean, what would be the reaction, and why shouldn't the standard be the same when it comes to the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, definitely the answer is clear. Iran is trying to stand independent. Iran is the major obstacle that they see in the Middle East that has prevented them from establishing their order and hegemonic rule over the Middle East in order to, get to China fast and try to slow down its economy. They have been trying to do so two times so far. In the first and second decade of this millennium, they tried to do so, and Iran never allowed them to impose their hegemonic rule and threaten Iran and, you know, the nations of the region. It was just a few years ago that a top Pentagon commander, was speaking of this very fact, that they intended to subvert and, decompose of seven nations after 2001 in a matter of 5 years: Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, Libya, and Syria, of course. And, you know, the only nation that stood against them and they never dared to attack it was Iran. What they do is trying to contain Iran first and, you know, roll back its power components growth, the growth of its nuclear industry, missile industry, regional power, in order to make it weak. And then once this is done, they would go for a subversion, for an attack, or for some other kind of subversion, like coup d'etat or whatever. So the only obstacle that they have on their way has been Iran. Iran represents a role model. That Pentagon commander mentioned it very directly, quote unquote, that we would and we should not, never, ever allow a country like Iran to become a role model for other nations in this region, because they are in pursuit of their illegitimate interests in this region. And Iran is the only main nation that's standing outright against them.
Okay. Well, Hafsa, what about that? Is it all about that? Is it on the one hand, the West's enmity for an independent Iran, basically not wanting Iran to become a role model, as Mostafa said? Or what's your assessment of it?
I totally agree. I think Iran is sort of sticking in the West's throat for various reasons. One, because obviously it's resisting. It has refused to capitulate despite the crippling sanctions and despite pressure that is unbelievable. It's still there, it's still standing strong, and it hasn't collapsed. And that is something that Western nations are really struggling to accept. But of course, it's also because it is the idea of a powerful, of a sophisticated, well-structured Islamic nation is something that is very problematic for Western nations. Because, of course, if Iran wasn't the Islamic Republic, I think it would be less problematic for many Western countries. But the idea of a powerful Islamic Republic that is on the verge of acquiring the nuclear technology, etc., is something that is very difficult to accept. And this is why the propaganda against Iran continues, the animosity towards both Iran and the Iranian people, because however much they insist that there is a distinction between how they view the Iranian government and the Iranian people, the bottom line is the sanctions obviously punish both the government and the people of Iran. So there is this constant propaganda against Iran, simply because I think Western nations cannot fathom the idea of a strong regional power in the Middle East, but most of all, a strong regional Islamic power in the Middle East. That is something that is going to be very difficult to accept, and that is why I'm afraid Iran should expect even more pressure in the years to come.
Well, Mostafa, with the reality of the world the way it is, with might making right, is there any other option for Iran and other independent countries than basically resistance?
Well, because they even acknowledge and make confessions about what they've done. It's not just about Fakhrizadeh. It's about other people that they've done. I mean, they assassinated Major General, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. And in this New York Times report by Ronan Bergman, as I said, he has made first-time confessions about three other facts, about assassination of two other Iranian nuclear scientists, especially with regard to the 2007 assassination of Dr. Ardeshir Hosseinpour with radioactive materials. Because they go unpunished by the world community, that means that if you just pinhole on international circles and on the UN Security Council, Amnesty International, and others, you will be the victim and you will be destroyed because they don't take any kind of action. It proves that language of force is the only language that they understand. Maybe that explains why the Israelis' growing attack, security attack, sabotage, and assassination throughout the last 2 or 3 years on Iran have never, ever gone unpunished one way or another. They assassinated Dr. Fakhrizadeh. They conduct a sabotage attack at Natanz facility. They set fire to Iranian woods, and they did some other moves. And they, of course, tried to magnify the number, and they went for hyperbole, and they claimed responsibility for dozens of more attacks, which were not true, similar to what the Ronan Bergman claims about the assassination of Major General, Tehrani Mokaddem, the father of Iranian missile technology. But they have received a response swiftly. You know, let me explain this. Okay. Maybe you're short of time.
I am. I'm exactly very short of time, Mostafa, and hopefully on another show we'll talk about it again. I appreciate both of you being with me here on the spotlight. Hafsakar Mostafa, journalist and political analyst out of London. Mostafa Khoshchesh, journalist and political commentator out of Tehran. And, of course, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَلَوْ رَحِمْنَاهُمْ وَكَشَفْنَا مَا بِهِمْ
And even if we gave them mercy and removed what was upon them of affliction, they would persist in their transgression, wandering blindly.
The Almighty Allah in the 75th verse says, وَلَوْ رَحِمْنَاهُمْ وَكَشَفْنَا مَا بِهِمْ مِنْ ضُرٍ لَلَجُّوا فِي طُغْيَانِهِمْ يَعْمَهُونَ If we had mercy on them and removed the distress which is on them, they would obstinately persist in their transgression, blindly wandering on. Now, there is a special occasion of revelation mentioned in some of the commentaries titled as Kenzut Daqa'iq and Ruhul Bayan for this specific verse.
In these commentary books, we read that once there had been a famine in Mecca, and Abu Sufyan asked the Prophet ﷺ to pray. The Prophet ﷺ prayed, and because of this, the famine ended. Then this verse was revealed. The previous verses spoke of various excuses that the deniers of truth made to disobey the call of the prophets. In this verse, Allah talks about awakening them and giving them the final argument. Step by step, the argument will be completed from this verse on. This verse indicates that, first of all, it is Almighty Allah who bestows blessings upon them to awake. Then, it implies that even if Allah showers blessings upon them and keeps away waves of disaster and distress from them, they are so impure that they persist in their disobedience. They remain wandered in this field. The verse says, وَلَوْ رَحِمْنَاهُمْ, if we had mercy on them, وَكَشَفْنَا مَا بِهِمْ مِنْ ضُرُّ, and we removed the distress which is on them, لَلَجُّ فِي طُغْيَانِهِمْ يَعْمَلُ, they would obstinately persist in their transgression, blindly wandering on. So it is interesting that in the previous verses the Holy Quran says that those who believe not in the hereafter, they will be deviating from the straight path, from the straight way. In this verse says that they are the very ones who would obstinately persist in their transgression. This is one of the other results of not believing in hereafter.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, when we are afflicted in our life in this world, when we are having distress, when the calamities are showering on us, and once they're removed, this removal of distress is one of the signs of the Almighty Allah's mercy. And we should be grateful for this. But the point that the Almighty Allah is mentioning in this, and we can infer from this verse, is the fact that even if you help, even if you have mercy on the faithless people, they will not realize that. They will not recognize that. And they will continue in their transgression. They will be blindly wandering on without having a sense of gratitude to you or the Almighty Allah. So these unbelievers, these faithless people, try to misuse their opportunities, try to misuse the mercy the others have towards them, so they would continue obstinately in their transgression. And interestingly, the verse says, ولو رحمناهم وكشفنا ما بهم من ضر للجوا في طغيانهم يعمهون. At first it says في طغيانهم and then يعمهون. They will be wandering on blindly in their transgression. So it is the obstinacy that is turning these faithless people into blindly wandering on. This is what obstinacy will do to human beings. The results and the end of obstinacy is to be continuously and constantly in the transgression wandering. And not just simple wandering, but blindly wandering on. And the point is that obstinacy has different reasons. For some people, it is their wealth that brings obstinacy. For some others, it is their knowledge. And for these specific faithless people, it was their low desires that brought them this obstinacy. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Stop. This comment was made by families of the five slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now the households of the victims have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
I believe the reason that they did this in front of my eyes and my mother's eyes was to terrorize people. That's what terrorists do.
We have already gotten too late into this legal proceeding. They killed my husband 12 years ago, and I still feel the pain. It's not easy to forget such a great loss. The point is, America and Israel do not feel sorry for this, and that's why we ask Iranian and international judicial systems to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
We are now waiting for the verdict of Iran's court for international affairs. We will follow up the case in countries that maintain judicial cooperation with Iran. There, we will demand that U.S. assets be blocked and transferred as compensation to the families of the victims. This is to remind the criminal governments that their crimes will not go unanswered.
Israel has a history of targeted killing of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the assassinations, its footsteps can be traced in all of the incidents. In this video, recorded in 2018, ex-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Less than 2 years after this comment, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was a key Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated. Over the years, different American and Israeli officials have spoken openly about, quote, taking down the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry. The plaintiffs here say the U.S. was trying to do so by killing Iranian nuclear scientists, and today by enforcing the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. But they say both measures have so far failed, and the West is now urging Iran to sit and talk about its nuclear program in Vienna to revive the 2015 nuclear pact.
Plaintiffs here hope that their lawsuit against the U.S. will break the chain of Washington's targeting of the Iranian scientific community. But they say the underlying messages are even more important, as the case lays bare the U.S.'s double standards with regards to human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In many cities in France, anti-health pass protesters marched again in what has become a weekly protest. They do not agree with the mandatory measures the French government has established to obtain much more vaccinations. But the protest movement is weakening a bit. Important figures of the Yellow Vests want to re-engage with the original inquiries of the movement, more social justice and against the authoritarian policy of the government. They want to elaborate a political force that will be able to influence the 2022 presidential elections.
Today we are with the angry citizens against the health pass, but as the Yellow Vest movement, we continue demanding more social justice and less taxes and a participative democracy.
70% of the French have received two jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. Due to the health pass that people have to show in almost every public places, the virus is soon to be under control, and life in France is slowly returning back to normal. The National Institute on Economic Studies, INSEE, announced that the French gross domestic product, GDP, will increase with more than 6% in 2021, after a fall last year of 10%. This is good news for the economy, except that workers' rights are deeply affected by the COVID crisis. More and more people lose their full-time contract, which is often transformed in variable working hours and a temporary contract, less paid and most of all offering less job security.
I am a volunteer worker. I see the misery. We distribute food. There is much more misery now and more young people are in need.
During the lockdown, people with precarious contracts were affected the most. Today, the government of Macron is reforming the unemployment status. He makes the labor market very flexible. He takes advantage of this crisis to implement his antisocial policy.
French President Macron had once declared that an unemployed person just has to cross the street to find a job. For many people, this is only wishful thinking. The vaccination campaign is certainly successful in pushing back the COVID virus and putting the economy back on track. But the French population remains deeply divided about the mandatory health pass. Chris Denhant, Paris.
One of the major border crossing points between Pakistan and Afghanistan. For decades, on an average, every day tens of thousands of people have been making back and forth movements on both sides of 2,700 kilometer long porous border. After the return of the Taliban in Afghanistan, many Afghans are using Pakistan as a transit route to leave for Western destinations, given 70% unemployment in the neighboring country. However, weeks before and after the Taliban's takeover, The Western media have reported such routine traveling of Afghan citizens as being fresh influx of refugees into Pakistan.
This visit of
something the visiting UN High Commissioner have not denied to be the case.
The situation is better because there is no fighting. I have often been asked, is there big refugee movements? We have not seen big refugee movements. But of course, if the state collapses, we could see a lot of people trying to seek refuge in other countries. If the state ceases to function, this will provoke a crisis that is much bigger than humanitarian.
The UNHCR has reported nearly 500,000 internally displaced Afghan citizens inside Afghanistan. Their houses were bombarded by the US and the former Afghan Air Force during clashes with the Taliban in major urban centers like Kandahar, Herat, and Kunduz. Rest of Afghanistan largely fell to the Taliban after the US-trained Afghan army surrendered without any fighting.
We must make sure that displaced people can either go back to their homes, and some people are going back to their homes, or if they are displaced, they are under a shelter. And you know, many are not. Many are out in the open, sleeping rough.
Analysts point out that the real problem in Afghanistan is deteriorating economy, as Afghan financial system has been dependent at least 60% on foreign aid. With the change of guard in Kabul, the Western countries and the UN have resumed funding, which is far less than what the new government requires to stabilize the fragile economy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
One of the world's largest democracies, and on the wall of the parliament, which represent democracy, there is a sentence which reads, Vasudeva Kutumbakam. It means the world is one family, and this is considered the most important moral value of the Indian society. But this is apparently not the case anymore, considering the growing discord in the society. In recent months, attacks against Muslim hawkers have come under the spotlight in social media. Critics say hate crimes against Muslims increased after the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP.
In India, from over close to a decade, the Muslim poor community is being further marginalized. This is being done by boycotting the Muslim hawkers and small Muslim traders.
Experts say in India, the political notion has changed from a strong secular nation to a theocratic Hindu nation, which has given rise to violence against Muslims. Now, Hindu extremists have been busy running this show through social media. Experts say the country, which is apparently known as the world's largest democracy, is under grave danger of losing this title. In a nation of diverse ethnic and religious groups, now even beggars are being humiliated and intimidated just because of their faith and are asked to leave the country since they are Muslims. Based on reports by several rights groups, since the ruling BJP came to power in 2014, it has adopted various laws and taken actions that legitimize discrimination against the religious minorities and stigmatize critics of the government. Experts believe it could lead to instability in the world's most populous nation.
Everything is being done to further marginalize Muslims, including hate speeches, hate crimes, mob lynching, the citizenship law, criminalizing divorce, etc. Now they are picking on traders and vendors to weaken the Muslim community economically.
The ruling party of the Prime Minister Modi has fervently denied any discrimination against the community, saying India is a democracy and believes in equal rights for all. But critics say Prime Minister Modi's slogan of everyone together, development for all, and everyone's trust is nothing but a political tool to appease the voters as usual. Munawar Zaman, Press TV, New Delhi.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip took part in Friday prayer in front of the headquarters of the Red Cross. The event, organized by different Palestinian factions, aims to support Palestinian prisoners who are subjected to Israeli abuse.
We are here to stress that we will not disappoint our Palestinian prisoners and we will keep supporting them. Our prisoners are passing through difficult times inside the jails as the regime is attacking the prisoners, especially Islamic Jihad members.
Meanwhile, Palestinians consider the recent heroic escape operation of six prisoners from an Israeli jail as a slap in the face of Israel.
We are doing our best to release Palestinian prisoners, and this is an oath that we should stick with until all Palestinian inmates are free. We are working round the clock to hold meetings and put plans so we can liberate our prisoners and have them run us and with their families. Our resistance made a firm decision that the six Palestinian inmates that escaped Jilbo prison are on top of any coming exchange deal.
The Palestinian resistance mentors the behavior of the Israeli regime towards the prisoners inside the jails and those who remain free, demanding the international institutions to put pressure on Israel regarding the prisoners' issue.
The issue of our inmates inside Israeli jails is ongoing, and there are still two of the six heroic escapees out of the Israeli prison. We are here to express our total support for those inmates and all Palestinian prisoners who are fighting to achieve their demands.
Palestinians here stress they will remain committed to their duty of supporting prisoners and demanding their release. The issue of Palestinian inmates is a priority for Palestinians who will keep demanding their release until they regain complete freedom. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Demonstrations have hit Aden and other cities in southern Yemen. The protests came in response to the deterioration of public services and widespread poverty within areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition's forces. But the demonstrations were met with a crackdown and resulted in deaths and injuries of protesters.
It is clear that the Saudi-backed regime has failed in handling of the economy, and this is what prompted people to go out and demonstrate in the southern governorates. The price of the dollar in Aden is two times more than what it is in Sana'a, and this confirms that former fugitive president Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi is implementing the agenda of the Saudi-led coalition, which seeks to control Yemeni lands and destroy the country.
The governor of Aden, Tariq Salam, said what is happening in southern cities is the revolution of the poor that will only end with the departure of all the forces of the Saudi-led coalition, including the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, which controls the city of Aden.
Yemenis took to the streets of Aden to create a major popular uprising aimed at confronting the Emirati occupation authorities. And this is a result of the suffering experienced by the people of Aden due to the absence of public services, such as electricity, inflation, and high prices. This is the revolution of the hungry, and it will end when all the Saudi coalition's forces leave Yemeni lands.
6 years ago, the Saudi-led coalition occupied several cities in southern Yemen, including Aden. Since then, these areas have been paralyzed by a power struggle between the Saudi-backed Hadi government and the UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council.
The catastrophic situation in southern regions of Yemen has pushed people there to stage out and demand expelling the foreign powers. Observers say people have come to realize that the Saudi-led coalition's presence has only increased the misery in their country, where more than 20 million people rely on aid. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Since the beginning of the struggle for independence in Indian-controlled Kashmir in 1989, journalists in the troubled region have worked in dangerous conditions. The fraternity has often faced tremendous pressure from all sides, while many journalists lost their lives in the line of duty. New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in 2019. Since then, the fraternity has accused the Indian administration in Kashmir of using intimidation, surveillance, interference and policing.
I think this is an attempt to treat journalists as enemy. The adversarial relationship that is there between the organs of the state and media as a fraternity is very adversarial at the moment, since last 2-3 years. And this is a result of, you know, when you treat journalists whose only job is to tell story and who are storytellers and who are not responsible for the story, they are treating, as we call, the shooting the messenger.
According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, the freedom of speech and expression in Kashmir is under threat. Michelle Bachelet has also criticized India for pressuring journalists and frequent communications blackout in Jammu and Kashmir. However, India has often rejected any criticism relating to Jammu and Kashmir. Editor-in-Chief of Kashmirwala, an independent media outlet of Kashmir, says his organization has several police cases registered against them.
In the last 2 years, we have been multiple times called, summoned, questioned, interrogated or detained. And other than that, there are a lot of other things that happen behind the curtains. You get phone calls, you get people who meet you and they tell you that this thing should not be done, that should not be done. So that creates this sense of fear in you. You always have to look over your shoulder as a journalist at what is going to happen.
The new breed of journalists in Kashmir say journalism has been criminalized by authorities in Kashmir, and many of them, like Asif Amin, are being compelled by their parents to opt for other career options. Journalists in Kashmir say New Delhi is trying to control media outlets and newspapers. They say their career is in danger. But many analysts believe in an era that almost every individual owns a smartphone and has access to social media, controlling a narrative is impossible. Shahana Bhatt, Internet Minister at Kashmir.
Farah, a Palestinian girl in her fifth grade of primary school, is one of hundreds of wounded children targeted by the Israeli regime. Shortly after the Israeli bombing of her house, Farah was transferred along with her mother and siblings to the hospital where their father.
Farah and her brothers and sisters were sleeping at home when the Israeli regime hit our house with no prior notice. They brought my kids to the very hospital where I work in. I was really shocked to see them. I've never expected to see my family in such a horrible condition. Farah was severely injured.
Farah, whose injury was highly critical, stayed for 7 days in a Shifa hospital, but her injury was severe and required traveling to Jordan for treatment. Unfortunately, all attempts failed to save Farah's legs, and she was eventually amputated.
Despite the fact that Farah has artificial legs, her morale is high. I thought that I would never see my child walking again, but now she's walking with her artificial legs.
Despite losing her legs, Farah is coming back from her treatment trip to take up her education in the school, where her teacher and classmates held a welcoming event for her.
I'm happy to be here and to see my friends once again. I'll do my best to continue my study. I know that I have to be strong and I will not give up my rights, whatever happens.
We held this ceremony to welcome Farah back from Jordan, where she spent a long treatment journey. Farah represents our Palestinian patience and resilience. She recovered from her injury and now is resuming her study. I have another 1,000 students here in this school, 20 of whom were injured during the latest Israeli escalation. Most of them have suffered from psychological stress.
Farah is now classified among a group of Palestinian children whose legs were amputated by the Israeli regime during the escalations over the Gaza Strip in serious violations of the right to life and childhood. Children in Gaza are one of the victims of the Israeli crimes. The regime has deprived them the right to live in safety. Nearly 70 children in Gaza were killed and hundreds were injured during the 2021 conflict. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
By the European Commission's own admission, the EU failed miserably to react when COVID-19 took hold in the 27-country bloc. In March last year, it was left to Russia, yes, Russia, to fly in medical supplies to the worst-hit nation at the time, Italy. This as neighbouring EU countries closed their borders while Rome cried out for help.
We responded with ad hoc solutions. But had we had HERA at that time, our preparedness and our crisis response would have been significantly different.
HERA is the Health Emergency Response Authority, a new €6 billion agency just unveiled by the European Commission. At the launch, EU Commissioner Margaritis Schinas was attempting to big things up.
Europe is the most vaccinated country in the world.
Aside from calling the EU a country, people might be forgiven for thinking the EU had illegally annexed the 17 European countries that are not in the EU. HERA is going to cost 1 billion euro per year for 6 years, yet another big bill for taxpayers. Some EU lawmakers are wondering if it will work. After all, EU agencies never got to grips with the 2008 financial crisis or the 2015 refugee crisis.